Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/HRN.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking organization. Not mise en place or keeping your knives in a row, but labor organizing.
If any restaurant worker is listening to this and is like, yes, I want something different, but I don't know where to start. First step they just need to do is to find one of us and get plugged in.
As independent contractors, they can't directly tell people, you know, when or where to work, but by using sort of gamified nudges to push people, that is sort of how they move the workforce around.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Ahiko Tema,
food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen in sakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Don Mei, who is the owner and director of May Leaf, the awesome tea company in London. Don also has a wonderful YouTube channel called May Leaf, which has 80,000 subscribers. I got to know him through his extremely educational and uniquely fun YouTube videos. And he knows a lot about both Japanese and Chinese tea, and his global scientific perspective of tea has helped me to appreciate Japanese tea even more. So I decided to invite him to Japan Eats, and Don is kindly joining us today. So today we'll discuss various aspects of Japanese tea in comparison with Chinese tea, along with Don's very intriguing path to become a tea specialist, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Don Mei. Hello, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Akiko. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm new. You don't know how much I'm excited about this show after watching so many videos by you. So first of all, your background is truly intriguing. So could you tell us about your family background and how you it led you to the world of tea?
Sure, no problem. So I come from a little bit of a diverse background. My mother is from Switzerland and my father is from China. My father moved to the UK, met my mother in Europe, and they started a business here, which was really all about bridging East and West with books and arts. So cultural books and arts, sharing culture from the East and introducing it to the West in the 1970s in London. And then that sort of progressed into an interest in medicine, in integrative medicine, in taking concepts of Eastern medicine, for example, acupuncture, Chinese herbal medicine, etc., and introducing it to the West. And this was the 1970s in London, so very different from today. And they started the first Chinese medical clinic in the UK. And that's sort of my background. My upbringing has always been around being introduced to Chinese arts, books, and medicine. I've been having acupuncture since I was a little boy. And this concept of bridging East and West, which has always been paramount in my family.
Right. And you personally also, you have a very interesting background. You spent some time in New York City, where we are now. So tell us about that too.
Yeah, I have a lot of love for NYC. I had the privilege of studying at NYU there. I studied film and TV at NYU for a few years. And I still have family out in New York from my father's side. So my uncle's out there. And so, yeah, I've lots of fond memories of New York, and I'm always excited to return and enjoy the delights, especially the culinary delights of that amazing city. And yeah, so I studied there, film and TV, and I came back to the UK after graduation, and I got involved in the music industry for a while. I was a sound engineer and worked as a producer. I had my own record label. But the family business was always bubbling around in the background, and I sort of got involved in the family business, and that's where I really sort of discovered my true passion in life, which is tea.
Right. So, but when you grew up, did you taste a lot of tea?
Actually, no. I mean, you know, it's one of the strange things about Chinese culture is that you know, everybody in China assumes it's their birthright to know a lot about tea. But in fact, you know, there is a lot of good tea being drunk in China, but there's also a lot of bad tea being drunk in China as well. And my father, you know, only knew as much as he knew. We would have green tea and jasmine tea, but nothing particularly special. It was only once I really sort of decided to dive into learning and exploring tea that I really had that revelation where I suddenly realized that this was a whole other world that I had never experienced before.
Right. I have the exact same feeling about the tea. I just took it so for granted that I didn't appreciate anything when I grew up. So,
yeah, I think it's quite common if you're brought up in a culture where sort of tea is the norm, you just sort of take it for granted. But as we'll find out, there are so many different grades of tea. And I soon discovered that I had been drinking pretty average stuff my whole life until I started to discover tea properly.
Right. Okay, so what is Mayleaf and what is your mission at Mayleaf?
Well, so my sort of venture into tea started just as a side project, really. It was, as I said, we have, as a family business, this Chinese medical clinic, and we were serving teas, but I recognized that the tea that we were serving probably wasn't representative of the best tea out there. And we saw tea as a really interesting opportunity for people to start to dive into more of the intricacies of Chinese medicine and Chinese culture, because tea is the most popular drink in the world after water and was the first Chinese medicinal herb. So it seemed to make sense that that would be the way to bridge people into discovering tea. So I started learning, and I soon realized that whilst most of us drink tea, 99% of us, at least in the West, have very little knowledge about it. So the sort of aim of Mayleaf, the mission at Mayleaf, was to really help people build a new relationship with tea, almost push the reset button altogether and start afresh with this incredible plant growing in these mountains, producing this amazing drink. So it's all about really trying to create a new relationship with tea. And we do that by offering information as much education as possible. We have our YouTube channel and other platforms, just trying to spread as much information as possible. And, you know, try to encourage people to join us on our tea journey, because we're all learning. I'm learning. I've been involved in tea for 20 years, but I still consider myself a very much a tea student. And so just sort of learning with us as we try to decipher all of the intricacies of this incredible drink, and then to curate the best teas of the season. So every year I taste teas. I'm currently in the midst of a crazy spring tea tasting. So I'm tasting something in the region of about 30 or 40 teas a day, and wow. trying to narrow it down and curate the best teas that I'm collecting from the mountains, and hopefully providing a trusted range of tea, which is always changing. The catalog never stays the same, because every year it changes. And that's one of the amazing things about tea, and keeps me in a job, is that you have to celebrate impermanence when you have a love affair with tea, because it's always changing. And so to educate, to make tea accessible, and to provide a trusted range of pinnacle teas every year. That's our mission.
Right. So for our students, like, it's just like trying to understand how the nature works, that kind of thing. So there's nothing, no end to finish.
Oh, with. Absolutely. There is no end. That's one of the things I love about it.
Right. And you mentioned your YouTube channel. So one of the reasons I really love watching your YouTube videos is that you are clearly deeply excited about understanding and tasting each tea. So, and my favorite part always is that when you describe tea's aroma, flavors, taste, and subtle notes with profuse and accurate words. So why is tea so special to you personally? Like, you know, it could have been wine, or you could probably capture all those subtle tastes of wine, for example.
I think that, so I've always had a deep passion for cooking and for food and for tasting. Tasting for me is one of the absolute joys in life. Not just for the sensorial aspect of tasting, but also for all that it brings you in terms of contextualizing your life, in terms of memories, in terms of relationships, in terms of all of those beautiful things that that sort of tag on to the whole food and drink experience of living. I've always loved taste. With tea, I think what's amazing about tea is that the subtlety of tea requires extra focus. And that's not to say, of course, that, you know, tasting wines and tasting coffees and tasting whiskies doesn't involve some subtlety. But a lot of the times with those kinds of foods and drinks, the taste comes to you rather than you have to go to the taste. And what I mean by that is, if you're not engaged, if your mind isn't engaged, if you're not focused, then the tea experience quickly disappears. Like, you know, the tea experience requires your presence. It requires your attention. And finding the tasting notes in tea, I find, is a very therapeutic exciting, sure, enjoyable, of course, indulgent, yes, but it's the seeking aspect of it that I think is so remarkable, and what makes the tasting of tea so special for me. And tea sits, at the heart of so many interesting trends, from cultural understanding, artisanship, provenance, history, health, function, happiness, positivity, and all of these things, as well as taste. And so it's just a remarkable, remarkable drink to get involved in, because it seems to just be so incredibly indulgent and provide so much positivity, and doesn't have any downsides. And there aren't many things in life that you can say that about. So it's that, plus the fact that it's a forever learning experience, means that I know that even in 50 years' time, I'll still be a student. And I really love that.
Right. I can tell the way you describe the flavors and taste, it doesn't come from, you know, your spice counter. It's more like your life experience. So yeah, I really admire how you describe the flavors. It's about life, not just on your tongue.
Yeah, absolutely. Taste is everyone's taste is different because it's based on your memory. You know, the way that the science of taste works relies on activating your memory senses centers in order to try to pick out and deconstruct flavor. And so I think that taste is much more than simply the ingredients, but it's also about the experience, and sometimes that means that tasting notes become a little bit flowery, but that's okay as long as it's personal, I think.
Right, so there's no right answer, it's how much you enjoy it, I guess.
Absolutely.
Right, so let's talk about tea itself. So you have tremendous knowledge of Chinese tea as well as Japanese tea, so what is the difference between Chinese and Japanese tea in terms of how they are grown and processed?
Well, there's a lot of similarities, of course. It's the same plant, albeit different cultivars, and it's tended and loved, hopefully by good producers with a similar level of passion. But there are some key differences. I think one of the differences is what the desired end result is that the producer is trying to attain. With Chinese tea, I think a lot of the end result is about revealing the subtleties and complexities of the plant itself and the terroir. With Japanese teas, there is a lot of that, of course, but there is also a desire for something that is very potent, very therapeutic, very powerful, both in terms of richness of flavor and effect. And so that translates in all sorts of things from the cultivation. So with Japanese tea, there seems to be a little bit more man-made influence in the cultivation. There's a little bit more involvement by the farmer. Whether or not that be sort of tending to the soil, enriching the soil, or of course, famously with shading the tea plant in order to sort of manipulate the stress response of the plant in order to bring out certain flavors. That sort of manipulation doesn't happen so much in Chinese tea and is much more of a facet of the Japanese sort of culture of tea. The picking in China, especially for green teas, tends to be smaller. The picking in Japan tends to be a little bit larger. Again, focusing on robustness and developing a richness of extraction from the inner leaf material. And in China, it's a little bit more focused on the subtleties and aromas of the smaller leaves. There's a difference in terms of the production. One of the striking differences between China and Japan is China tends to be, well, if we're talking about the very high-end tea, because, of course, there are many, many hundreds of grades of tea from commodity factory-produced tea all the way to the very sort of rarefied atmosphere of extremely rare teas. So if you're talking about the top end of the market in China, it tends to be produced much more by sort of individual households. And they're all sort of doing their own thing. They sort of have their own unique methods. It's a little bit more secretive, I would say. Whereas in Japan, it tends to be that the approach tends to be much more about a slightly more scientific approach, more standardized approach, controlling every single factor along the way. Tends to be more of a conveyor belt system, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean that they have sort of timed and computer controlled every single process along the chain of processing in order to end up with a very high quality sort of the average quality of Japanese tea tends to be very high because it goes through lots of sort of controlled processes that are all sort of carefully monitored. And so you have a very different end result. In Japan, you get a very good average quality, so it tends to be high quality, and you get a more standardized product. In China, it's a bit more chaotic in terms of the end results. And you get sort of teas ranging from all sorts of flavors, even if it's from the same place. And it's a little bit more crazy, but you can find some very characterful tea. One of the key differences, of course, that people always talk about in terms of the production of green tea is that Japan steams their tea, whereas China tends to bake their tea. That's one of the sort of main sort of fundamental differences. But I think the cultural differences are more interesting in a way.
Right. It's kind of reflected in actually how each society works, right? In Japan, it's more consistent and, kind of like a predictable quality so that there's no bad surprise, but at the expense of some nice surprise. That could be the other way, but...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I think is so fascinating. One of the great things about exploring tea at source is that you understand how the culture filters into the production methods. And you're absolutely right. You've got very consistent quality, very consistent levels of flavor. You know what you're going to get with Japanese tea, and it tends to be generally high quality. In China, it's much more random, but you do get these incredibly sort of interesting, phenomenal teas that only comes about through mad experimentation.
Right. And also actual processing. You said, Japanese tea, ryokucha, like green tea, is steamed instead of pan roasted. So what's the result of steaming versus roasting? What kind of...
In many ways, you could say it's similar to cooking, right? If you steam some spinach, it's going to have... a more neutral response to you're going to taste the spinach a little bit less affected compared with if you toasted the leaves over sort of very hot woks, which will impart a little bit more of a nutty note. It'll be warmer. It will stimulate a little bit more caramelization and those kind of toasted notes, which are strictly speaking, not part of the natural flavor profile of the leaf, but is an additional side to it. So Japanese steamed tea tends to be a little bit more bracing. It tends to be a little bit more fresh, you could say. But also, because it's steamed, the steaming process breaks down the leaves a little bit more. And so you have a softer leaf material, which means that it extracts more readily. So you're getting a different balance from the extraction. The water penetrates the leaves much more quickly than they do with Chinese teas. Chinese teas, because they're pan-baked mostly or sometimes air-baked, the outer membrane of the leaf tends to be a little bit more intact, and so it brews a little bit more slowly. And so you get lighter brews, you get warmer brews, you get nuttier brews, and slightly, I would say, sweeter brews potentially. But these are all, quite large generalizations, of course. But yeah, I mean, those are the main differences.
Right. Interesting. Right. And also, if you steam, the colors of the leaves tend to be intact too. So that's another reason. But it's interesting how things are trade off, like in different simple process of roasting and steaming. Okay, and by the way, listeners, I watched the video, Don's video, titled Japanese versus Chinese Green Tea Differences. That's on the YouTube of our Mayleaf channel. So I highly recommend you to watch it because you understand the whole difference in one shot. So anyway, so there are different categories of Japanese tea. So let's just talk about quickly of only Japanese tea here. So for listeners who are not familiar with Japanese tea, could you tell us the major categories of Japanese tea?
Sure. So the majority of tea produced in Japan is green tea, as you know. And green tea, the majority of green tea being produced is sencha. Sencha is green tea made from the spring flushes, so the first sort of three or four pickings of the year. And it's picked and processed, steamed at different levels of steaming, from short steaming to longer steaming. and then rolled. And that produces your archetypal Japanese sencha tea. If you do the same process, but you shade the tea bushes for about a few days to a week before harvesting, usually with sort of black covers that they actually just cover over the bushes, then you get kabusecha, which is a sort of slightly shaded sencha in essence. If you want to go longer than that and you want to shade for sort of 20 days up to a month, then that produces gyokuro. Gyokuro is, so when you shade a tea bush, what happens is that the plant undergoes some stress, and don't let that make you feel squeamish. Most of the flavor development in tea comes from stress, believe it or not, either stress from nature or stress from man. So that's common, because the flavor profiles in tea, all of the terpenes and the aroma molecules and the flavors tend to come from what's called secondary metabolites. In other words, the plant is reacting to its environment. And so when you shade a plant, it's obviously freaking out a little bit because it's not getting any sunlight or less sunlight. And so what it does is it protects certain compounds, one of which is called theanine. And theanine is one of the wonderful amino acids in tea, which is you can only really get by drinking tea, and has incredible benefits, which we can talk about later, but also contributes to a very brothy, very rich umami flavor. It's similar in a way to glutamate. And so the theanine is maintained, because normally when the plant is growing and gets a lot of sunlight, the theanine gets broken down into catechins, and catechins, the antioxidants in tea, act sort of like a sunscreen to protect from UV damage. So by shading the plant, you are no longer requiring the plant to create that UV protection. And so the theanine levels are boosted, and the chlorophyll levels are boosted to try to maximize any light that is there. So you're fundamentally changing the chemical composition of the final tea in your cup. So gyokuro has a very savory umami note. Sencha is a little bit brighter, even though all Japanese tea needs to have some umami, and then kabusecha is sort of in between. Then you've got tencha, which is very similar to gyokuro, but is larger leaves, and these are the leaves that are used to make matcha. So the tencha is then processed and prepared for grinding in order to make matcha tea, and that's by grinding the tencha usually with stone mills. Those are the main types of green tea in Japan. You've also got the byproducts of those teas, like kukicha. Kukicha is just the stems, and is a nice sort of low caffeine alternative if you want to taste Japanese green tea, but you really are caffeine sensitive. And those are just the stems which come off. And one of the advantages of this conveyor belt system is they've got a very clever way of catching all of these stems. And so that's another type of tea that you can purchase on the market. If you are purchasing green teas that are from later flushes, like summer and autumn, or larger leaves from the spring flushes, then that is generally called bancha, which is generally considered to be cheaper tea, lower quality tea, but can have you can get some tasty brews out of that. And then you've got teas that are processed afterwards. So famously, hojicha is a roasted tea, usually roasted bancha. You've got kamairicha, which is a pan-fried tea, similar to Chinese tea. You've got genmaicha, which is blended with toasted rice. But those are sort of, I would call them more in the processed side of the green tea spectrum in Japan. And then in Japan, you've also got black tea and oolong tea and some fermented tea, but they represent a much smaller proportion.
Right. Yeah. So if you go to anywhere in Japan, you can go, there's a little tea shop, and you can just go in and you can have a whole bunch of this, the whole spectrum of the types of tea that you just explained. So it's a lot, but it's always available, easily, you know, approachable. You can just grab a bag. It's not too expensive. I mean, gyokuro tend to be a little higher in price, but it's always available and it's easy to make. So, and also it's interesting that you mentioned if you cover the tea leaves, the umami goes up. So whenever I taste, you know, matcha or gyokuro, it's so savory just because of the process.
Yeah. And that savory hit, that umami hit is one of the quality markers of Japanese tea. I mean, all green tea in general, even Chinese teas, you're always looking for that umami. It's sort of like the salt on the salted caramel. You know, it seasons all the flavors. It enhances flavor. It provides more sweetness, ironically, because your mouth is filled with this incredible savory to sweet sensation. So by seasoning the tea with the umami, you're bringing out all of the flavors, including the sweetness. But certainly in Japan, that umami note is very much sought after. And one of the things I think with matcha that a lot of people, when they first get into matcha, if they taste matcha, which is not such great quality, they're not going to get that balance which comes from shade growing properly, where you get a nice, rich, umami, savory note. A lot of people think of matcha as this sort of very bright green, bracing drink, when in fact, it should also have a lot of warmth and a lot of savory, umami, mouthfeel, brothiness, and taste. And so it's important that you have well-shaded leaves.
Yeah, it's not like a, you know, matcha latte kind of matcha. And when I taste a good matcha, I have this, you know, the umami. At the same time, there's some bitterness. And also the bitterness stimulates the sweetness in my mouth. So that's like a triangle. And that's the beauty of matcha.
Yeah. And it's one of the beauties of tea in general is this desire for transformation. In China, they call it huigan. Huigan means hui means returning to source, and gan means sweetness. But it's a little bit more poetic than simple sugar sweetness. It's also like the sweetness of, so you can use that term to describe, for example, rain after a drought, like sweet rain. You know, it has a little bit more of a sentimental, emotional feel to it. And huigan basically sort of represents that idea that you were talking about, that it starts with bitterness, then turns to sweetness. It's returning back to source with sweetness. And so one of the things that as you develop a taste for tea, you develop a taste for bitterness. You develop a taste for that transformation. Any tea which doesn't have that and doesn't have that transformation from bitter to sweet is in my mind, and I think in a lot of tea lovers' mind, an empty tea. You're looking for that that transformation. You're looking for that journey. You're looking for some level of a movement in the experience.
Interesting. So, like this, the experience of tasting and how you develop the will, kind of like when I have. You know, sip of tea, I started to, you know, to shut my mouth and then put the air through my nose. And then the whole experience is multiplied. And that smell, like I said, they call it a retronasal smell instead of the smell coming through your nose. That is a powerful tasting experience. So, yeah, I think that's right. So, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, I think it's one of the things that a lot of people need to develop when they are drinking tea is figuring out how to smell the tea, because smelling a tea with the dry leaf is not the dry leaf of tea, especially if it's cold, doesn't give off that much aroma. And one of the problems is that if you are going to the shop and you're sniffing lots of tea, you're not going to really suss out the quality tea by doing that. And this is one of the problems that we have in the so-called specialty tea market, is that the temptation then is to scent your tea or to stock lots of sort of jasmines and florally scented teas in order to sell the product. But you're absolutely right. Retronasal is one of the best ways, is drinking the tea and then breathing out through the nose. You really get a whole hit of terpenes that way.
Right. And another tips I stole from your videos is that you smell the tea when it's dry and then smell again when it's wet, and then smell tea itself and I smell the cup that's already empty. And it's like so many different spectrum of different experience. And I feel like I got like five different teas. It's very enriching experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the process of drinking should in itself be a journey from you're witnessing the, I hope it's not too flowery to say, but you're witnessing the sort of reemergence or resurrection of this leaf from this dry, dormant state. And you're witnessing it as it brews and as it unfolds and as it extracts. And then eventually as it no longer has anything to give. And it's important that you sort of take a sort of time lapse approach and make sure you grab every opportunity to get the sensorial information along that journey.
Right. Yeah, it's healing too. Really relaxed throughout that smelling experience. And you know, we discussed the umami forward Japanese tea, but what is the difference between Japanese and Chinese tea in general in terms of flavor characteristics?
Yeah, so we've touched upon it already. One of the key areas is the umami, is the richness of the savory note. As I said, Chinese green teas tend to be slightly less in the umami, even though umami is something that is very desirable in Chinese teas. I think that with Japanese teas, the aim seems to be to produce a very verdant, very rich, very brothy tea. And in order for you to do that, you need to extract more of the inner leaf material. So just to sort of explain it a little bit, when you have this tea plant and it's gone through this processing, you have aroma compounds which tend to sit on the surface of the leaf and come from sort of the juices of the leaf that have settled during the processing and stay on the outside of the leaf. And then you've got the actual inner leaf compounds which need time in order for the water to extract them. And with Japanese teas, due to the steaming process, due to the extensive rolling that the Japanese teas go through, you're getting, during the extraction process, you're getting more of that inner leaf material. And so you're getting a brothier, more vegetal, more rich, more potent, I would say, tea from infusion number one. And you will have less infusions that you can drink of it. Whereas with Chinese teas, it's a little bit more subtle, and you can get more infusions out of it, and each infusion will be lighter and a little bit more delicate and elegant. So that's sort of the fundamental, I would say, difference between the experience.
Okay. All right. So let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss health benefits of drinking tea. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy to use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/HRN. That's ju.st/HRN. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/HRN. That's ju.st/HRN. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "It's so good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/HRN.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Don Mei, who is the owner and the director of Mei Leaf, a fascinating tea company in London. Don also has a wonderful tea-themed YouTube channel called Mei Leaf, which has 80,000 subscribers. So in one of your YouTube videos, you featured a fukamushi in the Makinohara region in Shizuoka Prefecture, and I found your explanation very interesting. So maybe you could tell us what fukamushi is and why it's made in specifically Makinohara.
Yeah, the fukamushi style essentially means that the steaming process, which is the process that all green tea needs to go through a process of heating. What that does is that deactivates the enzymes in the leaf, which catalyze oxidation, so the leaf can't then turn dark afterwards. And most Japanese green tea is steamed. And the length of time that you steam the leaf is going to have an effect, obviously, on the end result. Fukamushi is a deep steamed method. So they're steaming the leaf for, I don't know, about a minute. What that does is it tends to soften the astringent and bitter notes of the tea. Makinohara is a very famous tea growing area of Shizuoka, and it is on a plateau, which means that it's getting more sun than if the leaf is grown on the side of a mountain. And so because it's getting more sun, and as I said to you before, the tea plant uses catechins, which are antioxidants but have a bracing, astringent and bitter quality to them. The plant uses those antioxidants to protect itself from UV damage. And so if you are a plant growing in Makinohara Plateau, you are getting a lot of sun, and therefore you need to produce a fair amount of these catechins in order to protect yourself. And so the resulting tea, if it was produced in the standard asamushi style, so the shorter steaming method, would produce a tea which is more bracing, more bitter, more astringent. And that's not to say that some people wouldn't prefer it, but generally, people are looking for a slightly softer experience. And so the fukamushi style was developed to round out the extra bitterness and astringency that comes from plants growing with lots of sun.
Right. So really reflects how tea is terroir-based, how regionally it's made, and it's very personal. And yeah, like you said, fukamushi means deeply steamed tea, and asamushi is shallowly steamed tea. So asai is shallow, so, or like short term. And asamushi, I think, is a majority of Japanese tea production. But I think lately, tokamushi is becoming like a boom. So it's kind of hard to get because this region made it very famous.
Fukumushi's is definitely growing in popularity. It comes with some downsides, which is that as you steam a leaf, it breaks down more. So it tends to be a little bit more broken, or a lot more broken. So it requires a little bit more care in the brewing process. But it's a very, very vibrant color. I think one of the things that people love about it is Fukumushi tea has an extremely, almost sort of a radioactive brightness to its color, and it certainly is a very striking appearance.
Mm, right. So, by the way, so now we talked about how it's steamed during the production, but you know there are so many ways to make tea at home. So Japanese is always associated with a specific serving vessel called kyusu. And for Chinese tea, when you taste high quality tea, I use what it's called gaiwan. So what is the difference between kyusu and gaiwan, and what advantage does each have in tasting and making good tea?
Oh, that's a big question. This is going into proper geekery. I love it. Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's a pleasure to talk about it. Yeah, I mean, the gaiwan is a very, very simple piece of equipment. It's a bowl with a lid, but it's I always call it the lightsaber for the Kung Fu Jedis, because it's like your necessary teaware for a Chinese tea. In essence, you know, brewing tea from if you're looking at it from the surface is a very simple thing. You're mixing leaf with water in a container, but within that simplicity, there's so much complexity. So the shape of the gaiwan, the capacity of the gaiwan, the size of the opening, it's very suited to aroma rich teas. Like we were talking about with Chinese teas that are focused a little bit more on the balance of aroma compared with the extraction of the inner leaf material. Kyusus are incredible because of the fact that they leave a lot of space for the extraction of the tea, more than a gaiwan does. And again, if you're looking to really penetrate into those leaves and extract the inner leaf material, that's a good thing. They're also made out of clay, usually, tokoname clay or something similar, which has an effect of softening and rounding out the tea, the quality of the tea and the taste of the tea, the texture of the tea. They also have very specific filters which are suited to Japanese teas, whereas a gaiwan, there is no filter. You're pouring directly from the bowl using the lid as a sort of stopper. And that's fine for very whole leaf teas, which is often the case with Chinese teas. But with Japanese teas, because it goes through the steaming process and the rolling process, it is more broken up, and therefore you're going to get much more of a cloudy brew if you're brewing with a gaiwan. So, I mean, clearly each vessel is perfectly suited to the tea that it's meant to be brewing.
Mm, right. I mean, every single Japanese family household has kyusu. I think it's a little pot, and if you just go to any shop, even supermarket, they have like cheap, cute kyusu, or you can go high up. But I actually got a gaiwan, so I'm gonna try gaiwan with Japanese tea at some point. So I don't know. I will let you know how it's gonna work out.
Yeah, no, feel free to experiment. Absolutely.
Right. So maybe could you pick a Japanese tea and tell us how to make a perfect cup of tea?
Sure. Let's do Sencha, because Sencha is the most universal and probably the one that your listeners are most likely to be able to pick up. Obviously, the quality of the resulting tea in your cup is firstly dependent on the quality of the leaves and the quality of the water. So I'm going to take it as read that you've got the best possible quality sencha and good water in front of you before we get started, because you know the saying goes that you can't make good tea out of bad leaves, but you can make bad tea out of good leaves. So, you know, even if you've started with good leaves, you can make awful tea if you don't do it properly. So first and foremost, warm up your teaware. It's important that you that the temperatures that you are brewing at stay relatively consistent, and therefore it's good to pre-warm your teaware just by pouring hot water into your kyusu and your cup and then letting it sit there and then pouring it away before you're starting to brew. I recommend, British metric here, but I recommend about 4.5 grams for every 100 milliliters of water. Temperature wise, it depends on the leaf a little bit, but on average between 70 to 75 degrees Celsius, that's I think around 160 to 170 Fahrenheit, is a good starting temperature. The temperature of the water is important because hotter water extracts quicker. And as we said, with these kinds of very rich teas that have been rolled, you want to control that. If you brew too hot, you're going to extract too quickly and you've got very little control over the balance in your cup. So cooler water is always a good way to go. So 70 to 75, 160 to 170 Fahrenheit. And brewing, actually with Sencha, it's a really interesting. Sencha is one of those teas, and Japanese teas in general, a little bit different to Chinese teas. Chinese teas, you tend to start with a certain time, and then with every infusion, extend that time by 5 seconds or 10 seconds. Whereas with Japanese teas, you tend to start longer and then go shorter. And the reason for that, again, is because of the fact that it's a very rolled tea. And therefore, the first infusion is going to take a little bit of time in order to extract, but once the water has started to enter those leaves, it extracts very quickly. So first infusion, I recommend between about 75 seconds to a minute and a half, depending on how strong you like your tea. Pour that off, drink and enjoy, smelling the leaves and tasting the tea. And then for the second infusion, you're going to do something shorter. Same temperature water. So again, 160 to 170 Fahrenheit, but now we're brewing for about 20 to 30 seconds. For the third infusion, you can then extend it to be about a minute, again, with the same temperature water. And if you wanted to have a fourth infusion, which some good quality teas can give you, then I would normally boost the temperature up to near a boiling point, like 195, 200 degrees Fahrenheit, like 90 to 95 degrees Celsius for about a minute. And so that way you'll get three really great brothy infusions and one fourth kicker at the end if you want a little bit of a caffeine hit for your fourth infusion. And you should be very happily in tea bliss after that.
Right. Yeah, I used to just read all those instructions. I was like, and I just did whatever. And then I once tried, just like you said, following the temperature and the time to steep, it really makes a huge difference. And you can enjoy it until the very end of what the leaves can give. So, yeah, well, thank you for the advice. So in Japan, the leaf tea consumption has been declining. So I got the data. So in 2001, it was 1,174 grams per household. And in 2015, it was 14 years later, it was 844 grams per household. And the data a bit old, so I would imagine the number is even smaller now. So the reason behind the decline is that Japanese people are now drinking more handy bottled tea, as well as carbonated products like mineral water. So why should we drink leaf tea as opposed to conveniently packaged bottled tea?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a trend which is worrying in Japan, and I hope that it changes. And I think one of the fundamental ways that it will change is by these kinds of conversations, because people need to understand that bottled tea, the taste difference, it's a world of difference. So the first reason why you should drink loose leaf tea versus bottled tea is simply the enjoyment of it. The taste of it is just a world of difference. Bottled tea is generally using cheaper quality tea. It's being brewed for extensive periods in order to make a very strong tea concentrate, which is then diluted. There's nothing to compare that with the taste of properly brewed loose leaf tea. The taste and also the effect in terms of its mood enhancing effect, which we can talk about a little bit later maybe, but just the enjoyment and the taste and really understanding the intricacies of the flavor of tea requires leaf. You can't have that with bottled tea. I think one of the other things, and it certainly is true when I visited Japan, I hear this a lot from producers that are struggling, is that with the downturn in people purchasing and drinking loose leaf tea, they are forced to change their practices. So by drinking bottled tea, you are exacerbating the decline in good, skillful practice and processing of tea. And so there's a sustainability issue here as well. You're sort of encouraging or forcing producers to cut corners and produce cheaper commodity tea because the bottled tea companies are requiring them to sell their tea at a lot cheaper prices because they don't really care about, you know, meeting anywhere near the level of quality that these producers may be producing for their premium teas. So, you know, you're encouraging a reduction in the quality, a loss of these skills, which are you know, part of the cultural heritage of Japan, and it would be very sad if they were lost. And you're putting farmers out of business because, unfortunately, I see this quite regularly. Farmers, the younger generations don't want to take over the production. It's not profitable enough. And the fields and plantations are becoming abandoned, which is super sad, really, really unfortunate, and needs to change. And I think it will change as long as we can inspire the younger generations to understand this, that tea is not something old-fashioned, but is something which is delicious, indulgent, and incredibly relevant to modern day living. And the supposed convenience of bottled tea actually does a disservice to your life because you know the brewing of tea is part of the wonders of tea and what brings the positivity of tea into your life.
Right. And in addition, there are so many PET bottles, which is bad to the whole globe. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I tend to think that, you know, I'm just too busy to make tea, leaf tea. Mm. But that's the opposite. Just because you're too busy, you have to have a moment to make a couple of nice leaf tea. So tea
precisely.
Made out of leaf tea.
If you're too busy to make tea, then that's exactly why you need to make tea.
Right. It's like a meditation.
Absolutely.
Right. And so you have a very strong background of Eastern medicine. So from that perspective, what is the health benefit of drinking tea?
Ooh, another big question. So tea has been used as a restorative herb in Chinese culture for thousands of years. And just like a lot of Chinese herbs, research has recently proven that the benefits are real, although oftentimes the mechanism behind the benefits are not fully agreed upon. So what I mean by that is there are plenty of studies out there which demonstrate that tea, the regular consumption of tea, is an incredibly healthy habit for all sorts of reasons from studies in cardiovascular health, bone density, cognition, skin care, all sorts of things. There are thousands and thousands of clinical studies. And yet the sort of mechanism behind it is not fully understood or agreed upon. And so it's very difficult to understand or to be able to give definitives about exactly why tea is great for you. People talk about the antioxidant theory, and that's certainly something which holds some credence. But also there's plenty of other theories, which I'm not going to get involved in the science of it now, but there are plenty of other theories around that. When it comes to Chinese medicine, one of the things about Chinese medicine is it's an empirical medicine. It's come from many thousands of years of trial and error, of testing. And so again, the mechanisms behind it are much more related to a sort of pattern approach to healthcare, looking at sort of the character of tea and how that affects people sort of from a holistic pattern-based point of view, whereas the Western scientific approach is to dive down into go through the magnifying glass and look at the components of things. Neither method is completely right. Both of them need to be sort of taken together, I think. But certainly there's plenty of clinical studies that show, for example, a couple of cups of tea a day. The large metadata studies show reduce your chance of having a stroke by something like 20-25%. Improved cardiovascular health, improved your ability to maintain good cognition. Tea has been shown that the theanine in tea has been shown to stimulate alpha brainwave activity, which in essence is the meditative state, a state of calm, alertness, which is why, you know, the tea has got such a rich history in Buddhism and in practices of meditation. The theanine in tea also boosts your dopamine levels can regulate your GABA, a neurotransmitter, so bring about a state of happiness and calm, which is why tea has been used, you know, for generations upon generations as your sort of go-to drink when things are stressful. Let's put on the kettle, let's have some tea, let's talk about this. The mood enhancing aspect of tea, I think, is something that needs to be also discussed when we talk about the health benefits of tea, because good emotional health is the gateway to good physical health. You know, if you're feeling positive and feeling happy, and you are feeling that you are able to operate at peak performance in a calm but energized way, which means you're not going to make so many errors because you're not letting stress affect you in terms of your work or whatever you are doing. All of these things filter into general stress levels, and all of these things filter into long-term health. So that's important to also talk about when you're talking about health benefits, and also just the aspect of the emotional health of, as we said before, taking time to brew tea, making space in your day, be that by yourself, which is wonderful, but also tea has an incredible ability to build stronger relationships. One of the most satisfying parts of what I do is receiving messages from tea lovers around the world who say that the drinking of tea and the taking of time to brew tea with their friends and family has brought incredible positive aspects to relationships, be that, you know, parents, siblings, partners, whatever. So stronger relationships makes for healthier people in general. So there's plenty beyond the sort of chemical compounds in tea to consider when we talk about the health benefits of tea.
Right, 100% I agree. And the tea has a lot of flavors that would complement food. So do you have any suggestions for food pairings?
Sure, I think tea, you're right, tea has many different flavors. One of the difficulties with tea is its subtlety. And so you have to be very careful and conscious when you're doing pairing, because it can be easy for the foods to overpower the tea. You're sort of looking at, in when you're doing pairing, for a few things. I would say that the minimum you're looking for is either a contrast or a complement. So a contrast may be something like the classic British approach of having a cake with a very bright, brisk, and astringent Assam black tea, for example. So just to sort of as a way to break the or to have a contrast in the mouth. So you have something very rich and buttery, and then you have this very sort of bracing, bright, astringent black tea. So you've got that contrast, and that provides an enjoyable experience. Next up, I would say, in desirability is complementary. So looking at flavors that complement each other, what would be an example of that? Maybe with Japanese tea, something like hojicha, which is a roasted tea. So it has natural sort of caramel and nutty notes, and maybe pairing that with candied pecans, for example. Like pralines, like that, those two would work very well because they're very complementary flavors. You're getting the Maillard reaction in both of them. You're getting caramelization, you're getting roastiness, you're getting nuttiness. So they're very complementary. The most sought after pairings are ones that do a bit of both. So you have contrast, you have complementary, and that brings about a third flavor. So a flavor that you can't generate just by eating the food or drinking the tea, but requires both of them together in order for you to achieve that third flavor. Again, with Japanese tea, so for example, a classic one is matcha and chocolate, right? So the bitter notes of the matcha and the chocolate pair very well. You're getting that complementary note. You're also getting the sort of warmth and creaminess of matcha with the creaminess of chocolate, but then you're getting the bright note of the matcha. You're getting the verdant nature of the matcha. You're also getting that umami savory note, which is then seasoning the chocolate, and you're getting this overall whole, which is bigger than its parts. I also really enjoy drinking sencha with goat's cheese. I think that works very well for the same reason. So you're getting the brightness and meadowiness of goat's cheese works well with the green and fresh notes of the sencha, but then also you're getting the contrast that comes from the creaminess of the cheese that sort of works very well with that the temperature of the sencha and the cleansing quality of the sencha sort of cuts it. So getting a combination of contrasts and complements, I think, is the ultimate and requires a little bit of experimentation, but it's certainly an enjoyable activity.
Interesting. Yeah, actually, you know, that you said 1+1 and create the third one. That's like the moment of the beauty of pairings. And I have a friend, he loves drinking alcohol and he pairs everything, any kind of food with alcohol. But he said, I only drink green tea when I go to sushi restaurant because sushi's umami goes well with the tea's umami. So that's like the total compliment. And even he said that. So there's a magic about tea. Okay. So personally, when do you drink Japanese tea and when you drink Chinese tea, do you have any kind of demarcation?
So Japanese tea, as we've said before, is more potent. It's richer in caffeine. It's richer in theanine. So it overall, it has more of a physical effect than Chinese tea, which all tea has a physical effect on you. But Japanese tea is certainly more potent. I tend to drink Japanese tea either in mid-morning or mid-afternoon. I don't really drink it first thing in the morning. It's a bit too strong for my sensibilities first thing in the morning. So I tend to go for a Chinese green tea usually in the morning. And then when I feel like I want that hit, that boost, that mood enhancing, alpha brainwave activity energy, then that's when I'll reach for either a matcha or a Japanese green tea.
Good to know. Okay. So, yeah, so finally, I have endless questions, but I think we have to wrap up. So where can we find your updates online and social media?
So we've got our website, mayleaf.com, and we've got our YouTube channel. You just search for Mayleaf, M-E-I, Leaf. You can find us on YouTube, and you can watch our educational stroke, hopefully slightly entertaining videos. We've also got our Instagram feed as well, and Facebook. But Instagram and YouTube are the main places that we really sort of are active. I also should say that we've created a little coupon code for listeners until the end of July. So if you go to mayleaf.com, you can type in Japan Eats at the coupon at the checkout, and you get 20% off discountable products. So a little bonus for your listeners.
Thank you so much. And I'll be joining our listeners. okay, so thank you so much for joining us today, Don. And I know it's getting late in London, so I really appreciate your time too.
It was an absolute pleasure, Akiko.
Right, thank you so much. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@theheritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japan Eats is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Aman Wang, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.